We are the boat, we are the sea. I sail in you, you sail in me. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. There's a phrase that's been going through my head because of this contradictory season of Lent. As I mentioned last Sunday, Nietzsche's comment that Christianity was that miserable way of perishing, a kind of gloomy view of life. How do you have a certain kind of balance? And what came to my mind was the phrase, Houston, we have a problem. In terms of how do you interpret life? Because it is amazingly wonderful. And we look at human history and what's going on in the world, and it's amazingly awful at the same time. How do you have kind of balance? And I thought of the phrase in one of Wendell Berry's poems, be joyful though you've considered all the facts. That is an important sort of a mantra for me. And the other is it was attributed to James Boswell talking about Dr. Johnson, but it comes up, I think, in Leonard Cohen and all sorts of places, which is Dr. Johnson, you are a philosopher. I've tried to be a philosopher, but cheerfulness keeps breaking in. And how do you have a kind of cheerfulness and balance without seeming Pollyanna-ish or sentimental? And what we look for is a kind of playful realism, a humility before the unknown, because we do not know what's coming, and we only have a little bit of light as we really do walk one step at a time. I was reading a bit of history this week, and there was from a history book, a historian writing in 1911 saying that there will never be any more wars, there is just one world, and war will be so totally obsolete like having a duel. And you know what happened in 1914. You never know what's happening, and it begins a kind of humility with regard to life and how we rejoice and yet are realistic. How do you balance these things together? And the church tries to do this by the kind of rhythm of feasting and fasting, Lent, Easter, Advent, Christmas, to try and get a balance to all that we're working through. I told a story this week about two frogs. One frog lived in a well and the other frog lived by the ocean, and they were buddies. So you just have to suspend your disbelief and just believe that they, not only were they buddies, but they can talk. And the frog that lived by the ocean went to visit the frog who lived in the well and tried to explain what the ocean was like to the frog who lived in the well. And the frog who lived in the well said, what? The ocean is like so vast that it's like half the size of this well? He had no concept. Anyway, to cut a long frog story short, the frog who lived by the ocean persuaded the frog who lived in the well to get out of the well and make the long journey to the ocean. And you have a whole pilgrim's progress of frog adventures, which we could do, but you don't have the time. And finally they got to the brow of the hill over which was the ocean. And the frog who lived by the ocean said, wait a minute, and I'll call you up to the top of the brow of the hill, and then close your eyes and don't open them until I tell you. And the frog jumped to the top of the brow of the hill with his eyes closed, and he said, now open your eyes. He opened his eyes and saw this amazing ocean, and the story abruptly ends when it says, and his head exploded in 1,000 pieces. Now that is a cheerful thing for Lent. To come up with such an amazing view of life that you're struck dumb for a while. You're struck dumb and you're quiet. This is a very hazardous place to preach, I must say. So what we have to realize, if we know anything about history, is that upheaval, consternation is the norm, and tranquility is unusual in human history. And we need upheaval and struggle to understand the fullness and amazement of life. Why do we go through this? Well, I think there's two things that Lent offers us. One is a whole period of unlearning, partly because we think we know what Christianity is, and if we reject it, we think we know what it is, and if we accept it, we think we know what it is. And we need to go through a whole period of unlearning to come up with the shock of Christianity. The other is a kind of wake-up call to wake up. For me, it's a kind of struggle with blandness and niceness. I have a wonderful friend from Texas, and those of you who are from Texas, forgive my Texas accent, because I did mention Houston. But he said that his theology could be summed up when he was growing up in Texas, with his mum saying, God is nice, and we had to be nice too. And so being a Christian was just going around being nice. And if you're nice all the time, you're going to go nuts, because you cannot keep smiling like that. It's like the English woman who got fed up with people in the grocery store saying, have a nice day. And she finally said, thank you, but I have other plans. Please don't flatten me out with that. So one of the things we have the challenge and the disciplines is to face what the tradition calls the great unfixables, things that can't be fixed. And we live in a culture where we think things, on the whole, are fixable. Well, death isn't fixable. And one of the traditional things is to say, keep death always before your eyes. Not to be gloomy or miserable, but to realize that every day is a gift. We only pass through this way once. And how are we going to be and how are we going to behave? So death is important. As I've often said, we are all future dead people. And that means that we try and understand what a gift life is, what an amazing thing it is to be alive and to be aware. The other thing that we can't fix, and I certainly can't fix it because I look in the mirror and look at my face and my grey beard, is time. You cannot turn the clock back. You cannot cheat time. Time rolls on, and how are you going to live with that great unfixable? And of course, the greatest unfixable of all is love. Itself, learning to love. And it's not accidental that the mystics call this way of faith the school of love. How do we do that? And we're not very good at it. Most of the time, in our marriages, in our friendships, in our relationships, we don't have real love, we have reciprocal trade treaties. You know, I can remember listening to children playing in the schoolyard and one saying, I'll be your best friend if you'll be my best friend. It was a trade-off. Now, anybody can love me at my best. I'm lovely. I'm fantastic. It's people to get them to love me at my worst that's the trick. And how do we learn to love more and more, and how do we grow in love? Then we have these images from the scriptures. We have two great images, Abraham and Sarah, as it says, St. Paul says, as good as dead, a couple of old people. That's the hope for the world. Two old people as good as dead. Beginning again, this kind of great promise that God has for the human family. And then Jesus weeping over Jerusalem, that great city, and realizing that people miss the point, the cost of love. And so why do we have then this contrast between being joyful and realizing the fragility of life? We have it because the secret is here, that you won't be fully human, you won't be fully yourself unless you find a way of giving yourself away. And how do you do that? How do you find a way of surrendering yourself and giving yourself away? Coming home to yourself and realizing that the longing you have can never be over, that C.S. Lewis talks about joy as an unsatisfied desire, which is more desirable than any other satisfaction. You cannot have a sunset. You can't possess it. You can't put it in your pocket. You can't buy it. The things that matter can't be bought and sold. And this is the learning we have to go through at this season of Lent. So let me finish with a quick story. It's set in Crete. An old man who has vineyards and olive orchards and loves his island of Crete. And he shocks his wife and the priest as he's dying, by saying, take off all my clothes and lay me on the earth of Crete. I want to be close to the earth. And as he's laying, dying, he reaches out and grabs a handful of earth and he clutches it to his breast like this. And he dies, goes to heaven, and God, as an old man, is there waiting. We're saying, we've been waiting ages for you. Come on in, come on in. We've got a place prepared for you. Come on in. Just hold my hand and I'll lead you in. And he said, let go of that, let go of what you're clinging to. And he says, never. I love Crete. And so God doesn't force a hand, goes away sadly, and the old man lies there still clutching the handful of earth of Crete. And a million years goes by. You can do that in these stories. God comes out to say, come on in. And this time he's a young man. He's a young teenager. He's saying, come on, you know, come on through. Just to open up. He says, never. And another million years goes by, and God comes out again, this time as a little girl, like a granddaughter, and says, come on, and skipping around, and he says, come on, come on. By this time, this earth has got to be pretty dry. And the old man finally sort of sees it, the earth falling from his hand, and his little granddaughter, God, takes him by the hands, and the gates open, and what does he see? Crete! What you've been longing for is right here in the hearth under your heart. What you long for is right here. And it's a free gift. Wake up. It's a sort of wake-up call. And so there's a bit of a poem I wanted to share with you as a sort of finale. It's by Rob Brezhne. And it's all about a time to wake up. He says, this is a perfect moment. It's a perfect moment for many reasons, but especially because you and I are waking up. Waking up from our sleepwalking, thumb-sucking, dumb-clucking collusion with the masters of illusion and destruction. Thanks to them, from whom the painful blessings flow, we are waking up. News of the soul's true home is pouring in, unfiltrating our increasingly lucid waking dreams. We need truths in their wild state. Insurrectionary beauty that excites our curiosity, outrageous goodness that drives us to perform heroic acts of lusty compassion, ingenious love that endlessly transforms us, tricky freedom that is never permanent but must be reinvented and reclaimed every day, and a totally serious yet always laughing justice that schemes and dreams about how to diminish the suffering and increase the joy of every living being. What truths in their wild state are we planning to plant at the heart of our creation? What stories will be our reminders? What questions will be our fuel? Here's one for you. In the new world, you will know through and through that life is crazily in love with you. Did you hear that? That life is crazily in love with you. Life is wildly and innocently in love with you. In the new world, you will know beyond a doubt that thousands of secret helpers are angling to turn you into the gorgeous curiosity you were born to be. So if life is wildly and innocently in love with you, are you prepared to start loving life back the way that loves you? So, one more time. This is a perfect moment. It's a perfect moment for many reasons, but especially because you and I are waking up from our sleepwalking, thumb-sucking, dumb-clucking collusion with the masters of illusion and destruction. Thanks to them from whom the painful blessings flow, we are waking up. Thanks to them from whom the awful teaching ooze, we are waking up. So one more time, be joyful, though you've considered all the facts. We are the boat, we are the sea, I sail in you, you sail in me. Got it? Good. Thank you.
Thank you.